From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for Valentine's Weekend 2022. Your world champion Milwaukee Bucks have three home games this week, including Monday, Valentine's Day. Nothing says romance like a basketball game. Here's a perfect story for Valentine's week. At a zoo in England, they put two armadillos on a diet and exercise program because armadillos look like speed bumps with legs. The zoo figures this will help them be more attractive during mating season. Couldn't they just try flowers and candy like everybody else? Colombian drug smugglers took 20,000 coconuts, drilled holes in them, filled them with liquid cocaine, and then planned to ship them off to Italy, but they got busted. If they would have just put little party umbrellas on them, they might have gotten away with it. Every week I look high and low, scouring newspapers, magazines, and websites for material for this podcast. Well, this may be the strangest story to date, and there have been a lot of strange ones. From Fox News, Tucker Carlson says he is no longer attracted to the new, less sexy green M&Ms. Man, that's a special kind of fetish. A Connecticut homeowner accidentally burned his house to the ground while trying to thaw out the place with a flamethrower. Can't you just hear the phone call with the insurance company? And finally, this is definitely not a Valentine's story. A 26-year-old female high school teacher from Missouri was charged with sexual contact with a high school junior, but she got the charges dismissed by marrying the 17-year-old boy. She might want to think about ditching the teaching gig and become a lawyer. One call, that's all. On the podcast today, we have Dave Sandstrom, Paige Radke, Joel Dreising, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. You got a few of us on the podcast today. There's certainly, I think, we have something in common with that individual that may have been trying to thaw some pipes with that flamethrower. I know Ruben and I trying to keep our rinks in shape. The flamethrower is certainly an option we've considered trying to keep some good ice for the kids out there.
Zamboni?
Yeah, no Zamboni on the outside rinks, unfortunately. I think the markets this week could have used a bit of a flamethrower just to get a little more heat under them, keep things moving in the right direction. The NASDAQ down 2.2% this week, closed today at the bell at 13,791. For the year, the NASDAQ now down 11.8%, so still decidedly in correction territory for those growth-heavy NASDAQ stocks. The S&P 500 down 1.8% this week, closing today at 44,18. For the year, the S&P down 7.2%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 504 points today, down 1% for the week, closing at 34,737, down 4.3% for the year. So, you know, now really 6 weeks into the year, certainly seeing some significant selling pressure. We've gotten reprieve now and again. Last week, a great example of some, I think, positive steps forward, but it feels like at least for a while for the markets, it's been one step forward, two steps back, and kind of the typical direction is two or three steps forward for every one step back. So I think, you know, good to see things a little more stable the past few weeks, even if we've given a little back this week. I think the big news, you know, maybe this week came on the economic side. Joel, we'll touch on that in a second with the CPI numbers, but just to point out that the yield on the 10-year Treasury crossed 2% this week for the first time since before the pandemic began. We're now at 1.96% to close the week. But again, I think, you know, all signs point to continued expectations of what the Fed's going to do, continued expectations of kind of the direction we're headed. So that's maybe a quick look at the week. Joel, obviously, the economic news this week on CPI was the thing that I think caught most of the headlines, may have shaken markets a bit the last couple of days, but it isn't all that different than some of the news we've been getting, if only that it's pointing to a little bit higher rate of inflation.
Kyle, I think I saw in the Wall Street Journal this week a reference to inflation as the dark side of a growing economy, and that's kind of what we have. We have all of these numbers. We have unemployment insurance claims this week that are near a 53-year low. showing how reluctant employers are to let workers go because there's a real crunch for workers. And yet, yeah, we have 7.5% year-to-year inflation, according to the Consumer Price Index. And that's the highest it's been since 1982. Just to put that in perspective, though, I looked this up. You mentioned the 1.96% on the 10-year. The 10-year back when, in 1982, when inflation was so high, the 10-year was 14.4%. You know, unemployment now is 4%. It was 8.9% back in 1982 when inflation was that high. So we've got this really high inflation going on right now. But in perspective, we've got other things that show that there's some strength in the economy, that we, you know, recovered from the setback when the pandemic first hit us 2 years ago. And we've actually, you know, recovered from that and we're expanding. But those high prices are a downer. We had a report today on consumer sentiment from the University of Michigan, and it was the lowest outlook that consumers gave for the economy in 11 years. One of the big things was half of the households surveyed didn't expect to have higher income this year when adjusted for inflation. Now, that's the inflation that they're expecting, which might not necessarily be the inflation that they experience, but just that they're expecting to have declines in income suggests that they might feel like spending less, and that's, you know, generating 70% of our economy.
Of course, that's the virtuous cycle in some markets and the vicious cycle in others, that the expectation for higher prices leads to an advance in purchasing, you know, buying up goods today at lower prices with the expectation that maybe down the road they'll be more expensive, and by their very nature then driving some of that inflationary pressure. Unfortunately, we had maybe a different cause this time around, and that was that we had fewer services being chased, more goods being chased. Dave, I know it's something that you've talked about quite a bit, that I talk about quite a bit, is just the very nature of inflationary pressure has been in part a reflection of the fact that there's more money out there, but it's also that the goods and services that we're chasing aren't maybe the same goods and services and to the same extent, you know, that we were chasing 10, 15, 20 years ago.
That's a good point, Kyle. I think, you know, obviously it was kind of a perfect storm, you know, the pandemic shutting down manufacturing across the globe. At the same time, stimulus, unprecedented stimulus in just about every country in the world, flooding the consumer base with additional cash. And we saw the largest inventory drawdown in global history. We literally emptied the shelves of the world's manufacturers. And so, you know, the goods purchasing was at pace that we've never seen really in the country. So if you're looking for a little bit of a silver lining on the inflation numbers, it potentially could come from that transition you're describing as consumers start to move some of those discretionary purchases to service-based types of things, traveling, you know, getting back out to, you know, before the show, we were talking about concerts and all the different types of events that are coming up, you know, getting back out to restaurants and that service spending that could take some pressure off of that supply chain that's trying to rebuild that inventory of physical goods.
You know, I think, Joel, you pointed out the consumer sentiment numbers, and we often look at that as kind of a leading indicator for expectations for the economy later on, with consumers being such an important piece of the puzzle. I think what's unique this time around is, as Dave mentioned, you know, emptying the shelves, even if consumers are spending a little bit less, and in particular spending a little bit less on goods, there may be an opportunity to build up inventory again, and that could be a contributor to economic growth later this year.
Kyle, the University of Michigan report, the economists from that survey pointed out that there are three things in particular that are different this time, three caveats with these low sentiment numbers. One of them was the one that Dave pointed out, is just the normalization, the return to normalization after the pandemic and what effects that'll have. I just got plane tickets yesterday for me and my wife to go to Florida. And it's a trip that we were going to make 2 years ago at this time. And of course, we had to cancel at the last minute because of the pandemic. So there's an example. But two other things is the fact that the stimulus payments, that a lot of people are still holding that money. That people have more in personal savings now than they did before the pandemic started. So there's a feeling, there's a hope, I guess, that that money is still going to be spent. And then the third part is partisan politics, which seems to influence a lot these days. But these surveys have been going on since the 1960s. And the University of Michigan shows that, right now, it's usually the partisans in power versus the partisans who aren't in power. So whoever isn't in power will always sort of exaggerate or make claims that inflation is worse than it is, or that the economy is worse than it is. So there's that whole influence on people's psyche. And as you said, I mean, the how people are feeling about the economy makes a difference.
Paige, let's be clear that the Fed has every intention of making some moves on the inflation front. You know, Joel mentioned the unemployment numbers. I think clearly the employment picture, the labor force picture, has gotten to a point now where it doesn't need to be the Fed's primary concern anymore. And so if you look at CME FedWatch tools, which give us kind of forecasts for what the expectation is for moves on the overnight rate, if you look at the way that the Fed is talking, it's clear that some interest rate hikes are in the cards. Certainly as we look to March, it's a virtual certainty, it seems, it will get at least a quarter point and potentially half point move in March, although I think that's less likely. But you know, even as we look later into the year, it seems likely that the overnight rate's going to move pretty drastically. What should investors be thinking about? What's the conversation then, regarding what the Fed is doing?
Yeah, well, I think, like you said, if you look back to where we were, about half a year ago, we were thinking maybe 3, maybe 4 rate increases, but probably not until the second half of 2020 or even into 2023. Now, as you noted, there's been quite a shift and reversal in that, where the Fed funds are now pricing in 7 quarter point increases over the year. And so, to your point, does that mean, can they really do 7 increases this year, or are we going to see some, half point increases over this time period as well? And I think the most important thing to note is just when you're listening to what the Fed is saying, really listen, and you can hear different viewpoints, and, there's definitely some Fed chairs that are going to be louder than others. But ultimately, the concerns that we've been talking about are the concerns that they have been talking about as well. But I do think that it's important to note that in past periods of rate increases, we've still seen positive returns in the S&P 500 and also sometimes in bond portfolios. And so, even though we have rising interest rates, it tends to sort of be a stick to the gut. It's not necessarily a bad thing because, as you've noted, we're at very, very low interest rates as it stands. And so we have some more room to grow. And I think the most important thing coming out of the Fed is not necessarily how high they move, but at what pace. And as long as they continue to be communicative with what they're going to do, as long as we don't have any surprises, no sort of emergency meetings, then I think that the equity and bond markets are going to be able to find their way out of this. Maybe not in 2022, but you have to keep that long-term perspective. And just because you have some fear right now, got to stay diversified. Don't overweight in inflation-protected securities. Don't overweight in short-term bonds or cash. You want to make sure that you have protected yourself regardless of what happens. Some things might not perform as well as others, but at least you're not going to catch yourself in a pickle.
I think that's a great...
Or maybe, Kyle, maybe if you wouldn't mind putting this in perspective too, all the concern about the rising interest rates through the Fed, as Paige said, they're next to the Fed funds rate is next to zero. I mean, next to nothing right now. Again, back when inflation was this high in 1982, the Fed funds rate was about 14%. What's the difference there as far as concerns about raising interest rates at a time when they're so low?
Well, I think we need to be clear that the concern for so long was how weak economic growth was. Following the financial crisis, we had a very muted economic recovery. And the Fed for years talked about the 2% target for inflation as something that we were nowhere near. And this concept of, and I've mentioned it on the podcast before, but symmetrical inflation targets, that to long-term have a 2% average for inflation, it means you need to shoot past 2% for a while. I think that tells you the Fed was willing to let things run hot, but more importantly, they were willing to let the growth that we've been waiting to happen, happen. And so, you know, what that very short or very low interest rate had told us was that the Fed wasn't confident that that growth was coming on its own. The Fed wasn't confident that the economy was strong enough, maybe the way it was back in the 80s when we had a technological revolution in the way of computers, right? The personal computer became, I think, a pretty significant way that we saw productivity gains, those productivity gains pretty quickly making their way into the economy in the form of GDP growth. Well, it's a little different when you're talking about GDP growth and inflation at, you know, 1.5 or 2. Yeah, we're at 7 now, but we haven't been at 7 for all that long. And so I think it's important to remember as we look at what the inflation target really is and what it means, they don't need to overreact to 7 if it's 7 for a quarter or two, but they do need to, I think, as Paige mentioned, they do need to start taking those steps. And what we see, at least historically, is that the rate increases tend to be on an escalator, right? You get that kind of slow move up, but it's moved up in steps. And the rate decreases, the reaction to slow growth or the reaction to recession tends to be on the elevator, right? You're taking a quick jump down. And so I think this is a pretty healthy way to be talking about response to inflation. And Dave, we've got all kinds of history of how markets respond to Fed rate hike cycles, how markets respond to inflation. I know that's something that, you know, you have talked about in the past. I wonder, you know, kind of what you have seen historically, or what you've, you know, kind of what you've looked at historically as far as market response to these very cycles that we're seeing now.
Kyle, the S&P has actually reacted fairly positively to these rate hike cycles. If you go back to 1950, we've had 12 rate hike cycles that the Fed has engaged in, and 11 of those delivered positive returns, with an average over that time frame of a 9% annualized return as we got through those cycles. And, you know, part of that answer is fairly obvious, right? I mean, when you're raising rates, it's typically because the economy is doing extremely well, and almost too well in most instances, right? You're overheating. So that typically means, you know, corporate sales and corporate profits, right? So that's why you've seen that. So it can take some of the sting out of the corrections that kind of precede those cycles as markets kind of posture and position themselves for the Fed's actions. And I think the other thing to kind of note here too is, remember, 7.5%, that's something we haven't seen in 40 years, as Joel remarked at the beginning of the show. You know, there's an awful lot of analysts, traders, economists, and investors that weren't even born the last time we saw 7% inflation. So yeah, kind of shocking, right? We haven't, you know, a lot of people can actually say, I've never been here before. So, it, you know, it's not unexpected to see some knee-jerk reactions. And the last comment I'd make is, diversity is important here. And while you're feeling some pain on the growth side of your portfolio, if you look to the value stocks, that we hope and know that at least our clients have a nice footprint in, they've held up extremely well. And it's kind of comforting to see kind of a textbook reaction, right? The things that you've learned all the way along is value stocks should hold up better during these times, and they are right now. So I think that's another reassuring part of this particular cycle that we're in.
And just to stress, of course, that, you know, one of the things that's important about most value stocks is the quality of their earnings, right? And what we have seen most importantly in this market environment is that the most important thing you can focus on is quality. And so whether that's within the bond piece of your portfolio where, yeah, you might be giving up a little bit of price right now because, you know, rates are rising, you're pretty confident that that portfolio is going to be there in almost its entirety 6 months from now, a year from now, 5 years from now. And the other side of that is stocks. And while when the markets are rising, you want to participate in as much risk as you can to capture that, you know, that rise. I think these are the kind of markets that remind us that it isn't strictly about how much you can grow. It's about how well you play defense. And that is certainly what we have seen with a lot of the mutual funds, a lot of the ETFs that we look at is that they're as good on defense as they are on offense. And this is the time, I think, for investors to really take stock of the way they play defense, really make sure that, you know, the pieces of their portfolio are doing what they expect. And, you know, again, I think we've been pleased overall with how that's worked for our portfolios. But if you were overly aggressive, I think you're feeling it now. And maybe it's a sign that, you know, you got to pay a little more attention to, you know, both sides of the ball, as it were, as we come into this, you know, big game weekend. Got to be careful what I call it so that we don't receive any cease and desist letters from the NFL. But, you know, I think important to remember that you got to play both sides.
And Kyle, just piggybacking off that a little bit is just a reminder that, you know, much like we're seeing a rotation from growth being in play to value in play, I think at that same time, we're seeing a rotation away from sort of passive management, and there has to be a larger focus on active management. As someone who's been trained in fundamental stock analysis, I've always believed in the ability to find those mispricings and take advantage of them. But over the last 10 years, it was enough to just ride the wave. Everything was going up together and you could just, you know, sit back and relax and watch that happen. But to your point, now as things like quality, pricing power, cash flow all become a much more important part of the conversation, I think having a good allocation to active management to take advantage of some of the opportunities that we'll see in volatility is really important.
Thank you for that, Paige. Well, as always, we enjoyed doing the program for you, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.